Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 528. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about monasteries and stupas, glaciers, and Everest Base Camp as we go to Tibet. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Tibet. I'd like to welcome to the show Lee Deitisfeldt and Travis Bingaman, who've come to talk to us about Tibet. Lee and Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes.
You're welcome. So we're talking about Tibet, which is, at least as far as China is concerned, a part of China. We won't get into the politics of it necessarily, at least to start out. But why should we go to Tibet?
There's spiritual reasons. There's scenic reasons. And I guess you could also say intellectual reasons why you would want to travel to Tibet.
Lee, yeah, feel the first two, I think, are fairly obvious. The yeah. Buddhism influence, the amazing mountains and monasteries and monks and those sort of things. You say intellectual reasons, though, when I don't know where you're going.
When you are in a place like Tibet, there is such a depth and brevity to Buddhism that you really can't understand unless you're really experiencing it firsthand. So that is the intellectual component for me. On top of that, too, with some of my background as an appreciator of history, and not to get into talking about politics with Tibet and China, there is a lot to be had discussion-wise while traveling through the area about the situation of Tibet and what it means for the people going forward.
What kind of itinerary would you recommend for somebody who is going to go to Tibet?
I think it varies depending on what country you're from, because China has different restrictions for different nationalities. Mm-hmm. We're obviously from America, and being so, you are required to go on a guided tour. If you're to visit Tibet, you can't go over there on your own unless you have sanctioned permission as a researcher or some kind of worker or something there from the Chinese government. That being said, there's everything from 2 days tours that you can take of, let's say, just the capital, all the way to like 3 week excursions where you could go pretty much all around the country and see all the major sites. For us, we did an 8-day tour, I think it was, and I thought that was perfect. I mean, I'd love to have stayed longer, but I thought that was a good amount of time.
8 days was a great amount of time. Lee was starting to touch upon some of the lengthier tours, and some of the lengthier tours were more focused on the outdoor aspect of Tibet. So if you want to bike through, right, or if you want to get in some more hiking, those are the longer tours.
Okay. And you mentioned the capital of Tibet. Well, we didn't say the name of it.
Yes, that's Lhasa. Mm-hmm. Is the name of the capital.
So, and what did you do in your itinerary for Tibet?
Well, we started in Lhasa.
And we were there for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And that was partly to see, there's a lot of sights to see there, and partly to acclimate to the altitude, because most people come from lower elevation, and it takes about 3 days to really get your system to a point where you can really start going higher and traveling the rest of the area. So we started in Lhasa 3 days, and then the next 3 days or so, we drove, it's called the Friendship Highway. It's a highway that runs between Tibet and Nepal, and stopped at various monasteries and small towns. One is called Gyantse, another one is called Shigatse. The last day, well, I guess the second to last day, we ended up at Everest Base Camp on the Tibetan side. And then the last day we came back to Lhasa and left.
Okay. Well, let's do that again and more slowly and in more detail. So you were in 3 days in Lhasa, and you said there were a number of sites. Let's talk about the different sites you saw.
So while in Lhasa, you need to spend some time getting acclimated to the altitude. We visited Potala Palace, which is the winter palace of the Dalai Lama. We also, in Lhasa, the next day, visited the summer palace for the Dalai Lama.
Let's see.
The Dalai Lama lives in either one at this time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it has been, both have been the palaces of the Dalai Lamas for hundreds of years. So mm-hmm. The Potala Palace was built, I think, in the 14th century. So all the Dalai Lamas since then, I think it's like the 5th through the current, which is the 14th, have lived there. And then the summer palace, which is called the Norbalinka, I can't remember when that one was built. Around the same time, maybe.
Yeah, and that one has an interesting history behind it because it had been added on several times. So when you visit it, originally, I believe, and I could be wrong, it was meant more as a place of meditation.
It's okay. Outdoors. There's a number of gardens and wooded areas. It's definitely a place for contemplation.
Yeah. And it was expanded on throughout the changes in leadership with the Dalai Lama.
So they each have their own palace, so to speak. So you walk around and you'll see the 7th Dalai Lama's palace, and then the 9th, and then the 5th. And they all have their own flavor. For instance, gosh, I want to say it was the 10th, but I could totally be getting this wrong. Had a palace that was completely surrounded by, it was more impressive than a moat, but it was
like a man-made pond of sorts or lake.
Right. And so the water element of it with the water lilies and stuff around it was unique compared to some of the other ones, which were just kind of individual structures without, I mean, the water one just sticks in my mind because it looked a lot different than the other ones because it was seriously in the middle of water, and the other ones were just, they were impressive, but they were just buildings on their own without a moat or anything like that.
Okay. You spent the days, the 3 days, would you say acclimating to, you know, part of that is just being there and breathing and just waiting for your body to adjust. You're not doing anything specific to adjust to the altitude.
Yeah, we did take medicine for altitude sickness.
Okay.
And
preventive medicine, or did you start to get altitude sickness?
That's a great question, because one thing which I wasn't able to get a specific answer about for me was I would wake up in the middle of the night and it felt like I'd slept on my leg wrong, or during a car ride, maybe I would get this really strong tingling in my hands and fingers as if I'd been sitting on my hands. So there's definitely times like that where you noticed that your blood flow and your oxygen is not the same as if you were sitting in Seattle.
Okay. But it was preventative.
Yeah.
Neither of us contracted altitude sickness and then had to take the medicine.
Okay. Yeah. And not prescription medicine, but over-the-counter, I'm assuming.
It was prescription, okay. Yeah.
The name escapes me, but yeah, you can't just go into any pharmacy and pick it up.
Okay.
And we weren't necessarily thinking of taking it, but we did get immunizations for typhoid and hepatitis A from our doctors before we went. And while we were at the doctor, they said, oh, by the way, we're also going to give you prescription for this altitude medication.
And I'm guessing it was acetazolamide.
Yes, that was it.
Okay. And did you do anything else in Lhasa before you headed out?
we visited several of the markets and just walked around Old Town in Lhasa, so the original Lhasa.
And they, how is a Tibetan market different than a Chinese market?
And that's a really great question.
They both love to barter.
Yeah, barter. Okay. As an American traveling, definitely the first prize someone's going to give you is going to be much higher. So you do, if you are going to buy something from either a Tibetan or a Chinese national, you have to be willing and able to negotiate the price.
Okay.
And they like bartering. It's part of the fun. They pretty much expect it.
Yeah.
So if you're the type of person who kind of shies away from that, you'll probably just have to pay the highest price.
And yeah.
Okay. And what kind of goods are you bargaining for?
I mean, it can be anything from like a refrigerator magnet to a postcard.
And something extravagant.
Something extravagant. I had camera troubles with a Canon camera, and I needed to buy something for the camera. And obviously, we're used to a set price for goods.
Sure.
But I was bartering over this Canon camera.
Brand new.
Brand new in an electronics store, which is something I definitely would not have expected.
Okay.
So that's something you should be ready for if you travel to Tibet, is even if it's something we're used to having a set price for, nothing is, how to put it, guaranteed or final price.
Okay. Best thing to buy in a Tibetan market?
Of all things, I bought for my mother. She loves horses. She used to ride horses, and she's trained her dogs to ring bells to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
So I bought for my mother a set of bells with Tibetan snow lions, and she just found them on eBay for $400, which is funny because I think I spent probably a sixth of that price after bartering. So the bells was something I did not expect to have such a high price tag back home.
If you're the type of person who likes to go on vacation and go shopping, Tibet is not for you.
Yeah.
I enjoy shopping. I wouldn't call myself a super shopper or anything like that, but I usually go, like, we went to Europe last year and you'd see tons of food and beautiful goods and things, and you were always tempted by that. I wasn't really tempted in Tibet. That's not to say that they didn't have nice things. They had beautiful prayer beads and prayer flags and jewelry and wooden pieces. I guess for me, because a lot of those had spiritual significance, I felt awkward buying some of them, not truly knowing what they were for, or so I found myself not buying as much, but they do have a lot of beautiful Tibetan and Tibetan Buddhist related goods.
Yeah. I guess
I know in Thailand, for instance, which is another Buddhist country, people buy Buddhas, but there are also signs that say Buddha is a religious object, not a souvenir.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's two different messages coming at you. So
right.
That was
buy but don't buy.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to add to Lee's point, is if you're going to a place like Tibet, you're not actually going there to get the Tibet shot glass or the
they don't have it.
Yeah, or the Tibet Rats. Sweatshirt, you right. know.
How will I finish my shot glass collection?
Yeah.
Exactly. You're not going there to buy a lot of goods. You're going there more for the experience and the sights.
Okay.
So if you expect to buy stuff, you might be a little disappointed.
Excellent. Well, then let's move off out of Lhasa then and go see the sights. Where was your next stop again?
The next stop was a series of passes between Lhasa and Gyantse. And that for me was probably my favorite day.
And you're in a bus?
Yeah. So we were in a tour with six other people.
Okay.
And so it was kind of almost like a safari van. How would you describe it?
A Ford, so step a van. Above a minivan.
And we had an assigned driver and an assigned guide. And the first pass, I don't remember the name of the pass, but the name of the lake at the top of the pass is Yamdrok So, Yamdrok TSO. And that that particular site was my favorite. It's this just pristine turquoise lake. Mm-hmm. The sky that day was just absolutely clear with these big fluffy clouds. Like you could just reach out and touch them. And being in summer, because we just went beginning of August, the hillsides were just green, and there's all this natural growing mustard. So these very yellow flowers. Where you stop, there's this little building with a bunch of prayer flags hanging from it, and just all the colors. It was just amazing. And I think it was around 15,000 feet. It's mm-hmm. really high.
That sounds about right. Okay. I think it's important to note, too, with Tibet, you can't travel as a foreigner freely from town to town to town. So in between these rides, if we run into a different township or different area, you are expected to present your passport and your visa, your Tibetan visa, to whoever's at the checkpoint.
And your guide will take care of that, but it is kind of a hindrance. Yeah. You're enjoying the ride. It's beautiful. And then you have to stop at a checkpoint every hour or so. The next pass we came across after coming out of Lhasa was Palala or something. But there was a big glacier, and I want to say it was about 16,000 feet. And I had never seen a glacier before, I don't think, up close. And it was just this stunning, white, monstrous thing. And of course, since it's Tibet, it's these beautiful green fields below it with a bunch of yaks dotting the hillside and all dolled up with their little bells on their ears and all those things. But that was really spectacular, too, to see both of those things in one day. I mean,
yeah, the countryside can change quite dramatically. And the definition of what you're looking at is pretty extreme, too.
Okay. And you didn't have a whole lot of time, I'm guessing, to get out and enjoy the scenery.
Yeah.
15,000 feet, you don't really feel like a hike, probably.
Right. Exactly. definitely just walking around, you can feel it. Lee and I were both healthy people, and we'd both been running and working out to get ready for this trip. But really, you are at the mercy of the elevation.
Yeah, so. You'd walk up a flight of stairs and feel it in your chest.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I remember it just 12,000 feet in Rocky Mountain National Park doing a one-quarter mile, you know, nature hike and doing a lot of huffing and puffing.
Yes, we have been there as well, mm-hmm. the Continental Divide.
Yeah, for those of us who live at 100 feet.
Right.
Okay, and where next?
So after that, we went to Shigatse. And between Gyantse and Shigatse, in Gyantse, we went to a temple called the Khumbum Monastery. There they have what's called a stupa. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, people who've been to India or Nepal may know what a stupa is too. It's pretty much the shape of a building that's like the shape of the top of the Taj Mahal, that kind of rounded with bottom with the point at the top. But so they have, I think, the largest one in Tibet there. It's actually a physical building. And you walk inside, you go almost like a layered cake. You'll walk on one level, you'll go all the way around in a circle. Then you'll walk up to the next level, go all the way around in a circle.
And you say you go inside, usually a stupa, you can't go inside. It's not hollow.
Or right.
There's not accessed. But usually it's almost like a large reliquary. There are, you know, bones of the Buddha or somebody else significant that you're right. commemorating with that. So, you're climbing this, you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess it's a great example of how unique Tibetan culture is, mm-hmm. because you do, while visiting, see the influence of India, you see the influence of China, mm-hmm. and you see the influence of Nepal or Mongolia all in this area. So you see things that you might be like, hey, that looks familiar, but it is totally
their own thing. They've adapted mm-hmm. it.
Well, even Buddhism itself, while it's not popular in India, it did start in India. So,
right. Yeah.
And that was one thing that came up was the conflict between Indian Buddhism and the Chinese Buddhism.
Okay.
Yeah, Tibetan Buddhism, as our guide described it to us, is Buddhism proper plus kind of an animistic older primal religion that was present in Tibet when Buddhism came over.
One thing you can say is some of the religious figures can be shared. Like some of the Indian deities will also be shared within Tibetan Buddhism. Some of the symbols as well. I kept noticing while we were traveling seashells in some of the illustrations and murals. So I had to ask, okay, Tibet, we're pretty far from the ocean. Why do I keep seeing these illustrations of seashells? And as our guide explained, that's part of the Indian influence in Tibetan Buddhism.
And we're not claiming any of the three of us, I think, to be experts in Tibetan Buddhism. So
no, we're not.
I encourage you to do some reading on your own.
Yes.
What surprised you, though, when you talk about the differences between the different things? What surprised you about Tibet in general?
One thing that surprised me is how very much still the specter of the Dalai Lama is there. Mm-hmm. He is very much present in these people's lives. However, they cannot have an image of him.
I was going to say, I'll bet you didn't see any pictures of him, though.
No. Yeah.
There was one in the summer palace in Lhasa. There was one painting of him, which was the only image, legal image, of the 14th Dalai Lama in the entirety of Tibet. So you have this very interesting, sullen kind of feeling traveling through that I wasn't expecting to experience. Of once again, this person, this omnipresent figure, who at the same time cannot be mentioned, in a sense.
We both spent time abroad when we were in college, met some amazing people, did some amazing things. But just in our small 8 days being there, I walked away just really touched by the Tibetan people. They were so gracious and kind and helpful and patient. We went with a group called Tibetan Guide. Mm-hmm. And the manager is named Dondup. And there were so many things where, for instance, I actually thought the tour was 8 days and it was supposed to be 9 days. And so at the last minute, he realized, oh, wait, you were supposed to be here an extra day. And so, and the rest of the group is here. And he just really bent over backwards, just saying, it's okay, don't worry about it. And he got us alternative ways out and figured things out. Mm-hmm. And I've never been to a culture that was so just kind. And I mean, yeah, he was our guide, but this was just people on the street too, just waving and happy to see you. And
they really practice what they preach.
Yes.
They're very much what we would expect a Buddhist to be if you were to open up a book or a dictionary and read the textbook definition.
And that's what made me so sad to have to leave and to think if I wanted to go back, I'd have to go through the whole rigmarole of getting a permit and a tour and stuff again. Is I'd love to see those people again, but to get back is going to be extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. Where did you go next?
Before we got to Shigatse, we stopped at the Sakya Monastery. I believe there's three sects of Tibetan Buddhism, and this was one of the sects, and it's called Sakya Buddhism. And it originally comes from Mongolia. Most of the monasteries that we saw were painted white, like you've probably seen in pictures, with the kind of burgundy roofs and windows and whatnot, but this one was all gray with the burgundy too, but it was very dark and almost fortress-like. And it was built 10th to 13th century. But I think it was partly a fortress too, which is why it looks like
that was the Mongolian influence. So it's a unique monastery because when you approach it, it looks like it has these giant walls to keep you out. So when you enter it, you kind of feel like you're in some sort of secret or forbidden monastery. Yes. Of sorts, especially with the gray and the white and red stripes going down.
Well, and if it's the Mongol influence, then the thousand sounds too soon. Recently read a book on Genghis Khan and that whole conquest, and it happens as I'm doing this from the top of my head, late 1200s.
Yes.
So yeah. Century.
It's kind of out of the way from the highway. You have to drive another maybe 30, 40 minutes outside of the Friendship Highway to get there. And because that, you don't see quite as many tour groups, which admittedly, for instance, the Potala Palace was just inundated with tourists. But mostly there weren't a whole bunch, but they were there. But that,
and when you see tour groups, Chinese tour groups, international tour groups?
Predominantly Chinese tour groups.
Okay. And by the way, for those people who have been listening, don't know that we've just had technical issues. While we were having those, I looked up the monastery you were talking about, and it was in fact founded in the 11th century, but then became the place where Tibet was ruled from during the time of the Mongols in the 13th and 14th century.
So okay.
That's why you had two different dates in your head.
Yes.
They were both correct.
But because that monastery is kind of off the beaten path, you saw more pilgrims there too, and that was great because I guess during the winter time it's a lot of nomadic people. When we were there, I don't think there was many nomads, but they definitely were.
You definitely had a much more authentic look at some of the locals attending a monastery versus when you're in Lhasa, you just see a ton of tourists checking this out. You really got a feel for Tibetan Buddhism as it's happening.
Okay, excellent. Where to next?
So next was Everest.
Yeah, it's just higher and higher up, more and more elevation. Then you get to Rongbuk Monastery, and it's located at the foot of Everest. The thing about Rongbuk is so much of it was destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. They are still rebuilding parts and pieces of the monastery.
It literally just sits right at the, not the complete foot of Everest, but you stand at the entrance of it and you can see Everest right directly in its path. It was really great. So the difference between it and, say, a lot of the Lhasa monasteries was in Lhasa, you had a lot of ornate, very large statues of Buddha, mm-hmm. and sacred visuals. But at Rongbuk, it was very subdued, and just a few small Buddha sculptures. But it didn't, that was fine, because you could still tell that all these people had come through there, either Tibetans themselves or people wanting to climb Mount Everest or whatnot, and just leaving tons of offerings at the monastery. And that was very impressive to see. Just a tiny little place with obviously a lot of impact on people, mm-hmm. either coming through or who practice the religion daily.
Yeah, even our driver who was taking us from Lhasa to Everest got out at Rongbuk and gave his alms, his, you know, donations, and was reciting his prayers as we were traveling through. So obviously to someone like him, it is a very important spot if he's there to go out and visit.
You mentioned something earlier and I forgot to follow up. You mentioned that you weren't there in winter, which is not a surprise to me, but what month were you there?
August.
Okay. And is that, you went in that time because it is recommended because of the weather?
Partly that, mm-hmm. and partly because Travis is a school teacher, and so he only has so much time off during the summer, mm-hmm. and that just seemed to work best with all the other things we had going on.
And then you obviously had decent weather if you're standing at the foot of Everest and you're seeing Everest. I understand you wouldn't always have that.
Yeah. We didn't know till the moment it happened if you could, mm-hmm. if you would see Everest. And that was one thing we knew going in ahead of time, is you're not guaranteed to see it.
Right.
I guess I would say to listeners too, that if you want a crystal clear view of Everest in all its glory, winter is probably the best time to go, actually, because there's not a whole lot of bad weather going on. The worst time to see Everest is actually when we were there in the summertime, because the monsoons come up from India and the Himalayas kind of trap all those clouds and rain. And then that's how Tibet stays relatively dry in the summertime. But as a result, then sometimes you just can't see Everest. So we were going into it knowing we might not see it, but we luckily did.
So yeah, that's a good thing to remind anyone listening. Everest is known for being the highest peak, but it's a dangerous mountain to climb for reasons. So the weather there can totally just change, especially while we're there in August, within a few minutes.
Yeah.
Right, so literally, right. When we got the chance to see Everest, we were like jumping out of the car trying to grab a picture. Just because we didn't know if that 5-minute window would be the only opportunity we'd get the next few weeks up there.
And that's pretty common with any tall mountain can make its own weather. Mm-hmm. I know I was in Tanzania for 2 weeks at the foot of Kilimanjaro, and we saw it only flying out. It's the only time we saw it.
And another note I would say is, so we also went to Everest Base Camp on the Tibetan side, and if you are interested in seeing it in all of its climbing glory with all the people preparing to climb, I think they mainly only do that in May and maybe a part of June. So unfortunately, we didn't get to see all the people in their tents getting ready or coming back down. But if you wanted to, that would be the time to go.
Excellent. Now, did you have a lot of options in terms of what you did, or did they have a certain set number of tours?
So within our tour, basically you would usually meet the group at 9 in the morning, and then you would do stuff with them until about 5 at night. So anytime before 9 or 5 would be free time for you to do what you wanted to do. And that felt sufficient to me. Even in Lhasa, we walked around at night one night in Lhasa and kind of got a feel for the nightlife. It's more or less set.
I play music. I appreciate music. I love listening to music. And one thing I was very interested in going there was experiencing some of that. The tour group, especially, if I was to go to my tour guide and ask them a question about music, they'd be willing to help elaborate if they could on it, or point you in the right direction. So if you're interested in having something catered more to your interests, it can't be total, but they will be able to point you in a direction.
Okay. And then since you mentioned the word catered, what should I try to eat while I am in Tibet?
I will say, I guess that was one of the things that did surprise me, is going into the trip, we read all these things that said the food was just terrible and it's not a highlight of the
That's
trip.
What I've heard.
Yes, be prepared to eat the worst. I didn't think it was the best food I'd ever had, but I actually was pleasantly surprised
because
it's so close to India and Nepal. It was a lot of curry and tandoori and things that you would have in those countries that I find delicious. So
yeah, I'm actually vegetarian, and I went in expecting to have to eat meat, and I was prepared for that. However, I was actually able to go meatless, I think, the entire trip.
Yeah.
Usually in a Buddhist country, you'd have better luck with that.
Yes.
Exactly. But I was being totally open to if it happened, because I wouldn't want to go hungry, right? But that is worth noting, too. Like, it's not so horrendous that you'd go starving one night.
Okay.
We tried most of the traditional Tibetan food. So since I do eat meat, I tried yak, which I went into it very nervously, and it tastes almost just like beef. So if you were to go to Tibet and you don't mind the taste of beef, you'd be fine with yak.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not, they didn't name it because of onomatopoeia.
No. No.
Yeah. And even the yak butter and the yak's milk and the tea isn't, I didn't think it was that bad.
No, it's just, it's more like milk with butter and salt in it than it is a tea with tea leaves in it.
Yeah. Anyone going there to eat, I would just tell them, live a little, try some things.
What is one warning you would give about going to Tibet? You ought to prepare yourself for what?
One odd thing is being a white American, being asked for pictures.
Or just non-Asian.
Yeah.
I would say ethnicity besides Asian.
Yeah.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So that might be a total shock to some, but yeah, I wasn't necessarily expecting just being down the street, heading on my way, and being grabbed and asked, like, "Oh, a picture." So.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard that.
I'm 6 foot three.
Oh my goodness.
So I've had that. I've had that in Turkey, having the Korean tour group where the guy had to have his picture taken with me, and I just assumed he was a fan of the show. So
I hope he was.
Yeah.
I guess for me, I would say I'm not Buddhist and neither is Travis, but I do have a fairly deep interest in it. Mm-hmm. And so going to monastery after monastery was not uncomfortable or uninteresting for me, but I could see if you were mainly in Tibet for the mountains or the culture, if you had to go to monastery after monastery and see a bunch of Buddha statues, you might not be so keen on that.
Yeah.
I did a press trip in Thailand and they really want us to see every monastery. And there was a point at which we really didn't care.
Yes.
They were lovely. They really were lovely. But...
And at the same time, too, if you don't know who the Dalai Lama is or the political situation, you're going to be very, very confused about why you're seeing this and why you can't see this. So,
yeah.
As we start to head towards wrapping this up, I know from there you headed back to Lhasa. Anything else we want to cover before I get to my last questions?
Staying at base camp.
Okay.
It was cold.
You stayed in a tent, one would assume?
Yeah, and I believe the outside of the tent was woven in yak's fur, which is kind of a black, coarse fabric.
Okay.
But it's still very well insulated, and it wasn't as rough as I was expecting, and I think Lee would agree as well.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that was rough for me, both of us being from Seattle, we're used to, when we go to bed at night, there's plenty of fresh air, and it is quite wet here. And so sleeping there while having to burn sheep's dung for warmth made for me a kind of a long night.
Dry.
Just dry, and the smell of dung. It was.
You decided not to bring a lot of sheep's dung back.
I'm not bringing
it.
Yeah, didn't bring any back for gifts. But it makes sense, though. Obviously, it's such a high elevation. It's not exactly like there's trees out there you can just cut down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if the idea of burning sheep's dung makes you queasy, I don't know if ever space camp will be your deal.
One other thing about base camp was, so I mentioned earlier, we were in a tour with six other people and all different ages. So Travis and I are in our 30s. There was as young as 18, as old as probably 60s. And we really bonded during the whole trip because we were spending so much time with each other. And I really liked base camp because they put all of us in one tent. And so we kind of got to have almost a sleepover, and it was just one of our group mates. He brought some Jägermeister with him on the trip. And so after we'd gotten back from seeing Everest, he poured us all a little bit and we celebrated. And I thought that was really a nice way to kind of wrap up the bonding experience all of us had.
Anything else before we get to the last questions?
One of my favorite things while we were visiting in Lhasa was going to the Sera Monastery and seeing the Tibetan monks debate. And if you don't know what that looks like or what that sounds like, it could be quite shocking walking into it. Because to emphasize points, they will clap and slap their hands together. And the other thing that was fascinating, I didn't realize, while they're debating amongst monks, they're moving their prayer beads from their wrist up to their shoulder. And I didn't know this, but I guess when it's down to their wrist, that represents the suffering. And while they're debating, they're explaining how you move from suffering to enlightenment. So when they emphasize a point and then talk about how to become enlightened, they move the prayer beads from the wrist up to your shoulder.
Okay. Now, was the debate happening in a language that you were understanding, or?
No, but it wasn't. But that was kind of the fascinating thing.
It's in
Tibetan, but once you pick up on the technique, you can kind of see what's happening.
Okay.
And you can figure out, just based on facial expression and the interactions, where they are.
Last four questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Tibet.
I paid maybe a dollar, the equivalent of a US dollar, to ride a yak. Yeah, I think that's really only in Tibet can you. And I had to barter for the yak ride. He wanted $2. So I had to barter him down to $1. It was a $1 yak, in my opinion. So
when did you feel closest to home? This is so familiar. And when did you feel furthest from home?
So I'm from Colorado originally. So mm-hmm. I'm kind of from a mountain area. And I studied abroad in Chile, which has some mountainous cultures there too. And so I think from just the first hour we were there, driving around and seeing just the stark blue sky with the big white clouds and mountains and even the people that live in that area, in a mountainous area, I've never experienced this before, but it felt like there's a definite connection between and similarities between people that live in those high altitude regions of the world. That made me feel right at home.
And furthest from home?
Furthest from home. Maybe it's just the color. That was one thing that really struck me, was the vibrancy of the color, especially in nature and in the dress, in the homes. Everything seemed very bright to me. Kind of an odd thing to make you feel far from home, but it just really still sticks out with me is the color.
It's like the difference between the beginning and the rest of The Wizard of Oz.
Exactly. Now we're back in gloomy Seattle.
Yes. I would say the furthest from home for me was just the censorship, not being able to talk about the Dalai Lama, not being able to talk about the treatment of Tibetan people. All of those types of aspects definitely made me think of the freedoms that we have in the United States.
I guess I should back up. Being an educator and a teacher, sometimes I wanted to be frank and ask questions to the guide to get an answer for. And he would sometimes have to tell me, I can't answer that. Which that's something I feel like I definitely take for granted is the freedom of speech in America.
Right. You're standing in the prettiest spot you saw in Tibet. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
For me, it was the Yamdrak So Lake. Mm-hmm. Just you're standing maybe a mile up on a hill cliffside overlooking the
green hills,
serene and lake with not a boat, not a person, nothing in it, just totally calm.
Yamdrak So would probably be one for me, but I'm trying to think. At Everest, there was Malaripa's cave.
Yes.
In Everest. And it's literally, it's like a cave right off of Everest as you're walking down from base camp. And it's kind of a mini monastery of sorts that it's off the beaten path. You can't just find it in a book. That's something that still sticks out in my mind as, oh, wow, I'm not going to see anything quite like that in the United States.
Excellent. Finish this thought. You really know you're in Tibet. When what?
You hear a prayer.
You feel surrounded by just a serene, warm, spiritual presence. And I'm not a spiritual person at all. And decent, good-hearted people. That would be me.
Okay. And throw in some yak milk tea.
Yes.
If you had to summarize Tibet in three words, what three words would you use?
It's still there.
Okay. That's a little explanation.
But here we are past 50 years of the Dalai Lama's exile. And Tibet, the people there are still very much in love with their leader. No matter what the Chinese government has been trying to do, their way of life is continuing. It's still there.
Excellent. And nature is still there for now. They've built up parts of Tibet, but not so much yet. So it's still in more or less its pristine glory.
Excellent. Well, our guests have been Lee Deidesfeldt and Travis Bingaman. And thank you both for coming on the show and talking about your obvious newfound love for Tibet.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah.
In news of the community, I heard this week from Ashley, who said, on the podcast you mentioned you liked hearing when we buy slash use products or services that sponsor the show, and I wanted to let you know I've purchased 6 DKI Witness travel guides since listening to your show. We recently moved to Germany, and we have plans to travel throughout Germany to Holland, Vienna, Provence, and Spain next year, so I purchased all of those guides. Additionally, we went to Luxembourg City for a weekend in July, and I relied heavily on that episode to guide us since I hadn't done a ton of planning ahead of time. Always, I love the podcast and enjoy listening every week. Thanks so much, Ashley. Yes, that does help me, and I'm a little jealous. Holland, Vienna, Provence, and Spain all sound like a lot of fun. Have a great trip. A while back, I heard from Jamie, who said, I wanted to send some thoughts from a listener's perspective. I just finished listening to the South Side of Chicago episode and was pretty surprised by how there was no real emphasis on how dangerous it is. I've been to Chicago 3 times, and everyone recommends to avoid it. Being from LA area, I can relate, as I would suggest tourists to avoid dangerous places like Compton and Watts. I'm sure there are great things to see, but your guest would just say there are sketchy neighborhoods. How about she names some of them so that people don't wander there? Also, she said real Chicago pizza is not deep dish. Other than Chicago hot dog, the deep dish is known nationwide as a Chicago signature dish. I felt she painted a very unrealistic representation of that part of the city, also referred to as Chirac, by how many murders that happened there. On another note, hopefully your guests can be more creative when defining their country with 3 words. Diverse, beautiful, and friendly are so worn out. I know I shouldn't complain about a free podcast that is one of my favorites. I just felt I had to give some feedback or a rant as a listener. Thank you very much. Now, I should say, in terms of Los Angeles, I've actually been to Watts. I enjoyed going to Watts to see the Watts Towers and did feel relatively safe there. I don't think I would go there at night. I think some of the places in Chicago would be similar. Honestly, that show has been so long ago, I'd have to re-listen to it to know exactly what we said about it. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions or rants, feel free to send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave them as a comment on the episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram as Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.